Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Mark Harold, professor of economics at the University of New Hampshire, who summarizes his research into the number of Afghan civilians killed during the U.S. bombing campaign against Afghanistan. Victor Minotti of the International Forum on Globalization, who discusses the convening of the second annual World Social Forum in Brazil, where international activists dedicated to social justice will gather to confer about alternative models for economic development. And Roger Flynn, with the Western Mining Action Project, who describes the battle to save Montana's Cabinet Mountain Wilderness area from a mine development plan. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Some 11 years before the deadly September 11th terrorist attacks, the first Bush administration was worried about the state of airline security. A presidential commission created in the aftermath of the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland, concluded that U.S. airline security was seriously flawed and failed to provide the proper level of protection to the traveling public. The 1990 report called for major security reforms, including upgrading scanners at airports, creating a system to prevent someone from leaving a bomb in a suitcase and not getting on board, and requiring criminal background checks for those working at airports. According to Mother Jones magazine, Titan's security measures were blocked for 11 years by the powerful Air Transport Association and the airlines, which during the 2000 election gave $4.2 million to Democratic and Republican Party committees. After the crash of TWA Flight 800 off Long Island, New York, the Clinton administration established a new commission on airline security, led by Vice President Al Gore. One of the commission's early ideas was a full bag match to link every bag with an actual passenger, or the bag would be removed from the plane. Again, the airlines objected and initiated a full-scale lobbying campaign against it. In mid-September 1996, Gore backed off and agreed to the industry alternative of creating a passenger profile system to detect suspicious travelers. Almost immediately, the airlines donated over $250,000 to the Democrats in the final weeks of the Clinton-Dole campaign. While British Prime Minister Tony Blair has helped lead the war on terrorism, England is backing away from another long-term American initiative by seeking out the soft path in dealing with drug addiction. Last fall, Blair's Home Secretary announced that the Labour government would stop arresting people for possession of marijuana. The British government is also thinking about providing heroin addicts with controlled doses of narcotics, a program that has shown impressive results in Switzerland and other European nations. Labour MP Paul Flynn told the news magazine In These Times, "The drug war, at least in Europe, is over. Our course is to move to a more pragmatic approach towards substance abuse." Meanwhile, the Bush administration has put a number of hardliners, including Attorney General John Ashcroft and Drug Enforcement Administration head Asa Hutchinson, to run America's 30-year war on drugs. Among top American officials, attacking drug use is seen as a moral issue and not a public health concern. Eric Sterling of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation contends that American policymakers justify the most destructive elements of our drug policies as somehow sending an important message to our children. That makes it difficult to import even the most successful European policy initiatives. According to Vermont's Rutland Herald, on Sunday morning, December 2, 2001, 37-year-old Robert Woodward entered the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in West Brattleboro in an agitated state, claiming he needed political asylum. He charged that the FBI was seeking to torture and kill him. Church President Charles Butterfield placed a 911 call requesting plainclothes officers. Most of the congregation left the church, and Woody, as he was known to his friends, pulled out a pocket knife, aiming it at his own face, and threatened to hurt himself if no one would bear witness for him. Three Brattleboro police officers arrived dressed in SWAT gear and carrying pepper spray and .40-caliber pistols. In what witnesses say was less than a minute, two of the officers opened fire on Woodward, firing several rounds, resulting in his death. His parents, Paul and Joanne Woodward, announced Monday, January 21st, they were filing a lawsuit against the town of Brattleboro and two police officers because, according to their lawyer, the Vermont Attorney General's office has stonewalled them for information about their son's death. Although results of the autopsy have been denied to the public, the lawsuit exposes new details about the shooting, including that Woodward sustained 7 gunshots, one of which struck him in his back. The lawsuit, filed in Wyndham Superior Court, alleges the police violated Woodward's civil rights and that the officers were not adequately trained to deal with an emotionally disturbed person. The killing of Robert Woodward is but one example of a disturbing pattern of the unreasonable use of lethal force by police across the United States in recent years. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Denise Manzari. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
In early December, university professor Mark Harold released a report which concluded that the U.S. bombing campaign, begun in Afghanistan on October 7th, had resulted in the deaths of more than 3,500 civilians. Harold, a professor of economics and women's studies at the University of New Hampshire, has since expanded his estimate to 4,000, a number based on eyewitness accounts and international press reports. The report titled A Dossier on Civilian Victims of U.S. Aerial Bombing in Afghanistan, A Comprehensive Accounting, offers detailed analysis of the unintended consequences of the U.S. war in Afghanistan, which has largely been spared much scrutiny by America's corporate media. But groups like the Project on Defense Alternatives calculated smaller numbers than Harold, stating that 1,000 to 1,300 Afghans died in the U.S. airstrikes. Both the Pentagon and Afghanistan's interim government have declined to release any estimate of civilians killed or injured during the U.S.-led campaign to oust the Taliban government and their al-Qaeda allies. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Mark Harold about the reasons he undertook this research and why he believes it is critical for Americans to know the true cost of the U.S. war against terrorism.
It began because of frustration with the mainstream media, both the television and the mainstream newspapers, insofar as there was absolutely nothing or very, very little on what was happening in Afghanistan. All we saw on television and heard about were planes taking off from the Carl Vinson or the Theodore Roosevelt or whatever, aircraft carriers, and they took off and that was the end. And the next thing, we were brought to a briefing in the Pentagon where we were really not told very much else except that certain targets had been hit and there were some figures presented on numbers of sorties and types of bombs and weaponry dropped and the like. So it really was frustration. And around October 10th, 11th, I began working on the Internet and finding out that, lo and behold, out there in the world, namely Europe and Central Asia and South Asia and even Australia, there were fairly detailed reports as to what was happening in Afghanistan on the ground, which was not being reported here in the United States. What I did is around October 20th, 22nd or so, I began keeping tabs of everything I could find reported on civilian casualties, the kind of air war which was being waged, and began constructing this database, which now is a 100-page document with very, very detailed information, and I always list all the sources. There are actually 5 columns to each page: location, province in which the attack occurred, the numbers of civilian deaths, the weaponry used, commentary, and the sources. So it's a very detailed account, and I rely on three kinds of sources. First, newswire reports. The Reuters agency has been terrific, Agence France-Presse, the AP, but also outfits from the area there, such as the Afghan Islamic Press, the Iranian News Service, and so on. And secondly, the bulk, really, of the sources I use are reports in major newspapers from around the world. These are mostly from India, Pakistan, Britain, Australia, a few in this country, and the third source is the occasional report by non-governmental organizations. the only figures I'm including here are what I call impact deaths. In other words, these are people who died when the bomb exploded or the missile hit. I'm not including people who were injured and died subsequently. I'm not including people who die, fairly large numbers of people who die over the course of time after cluster bombs explode, and many of the bomblets don't explode and are picked up later by people and who die. You know, and I want to be really clear about this. I've never said that there was intentional targeting of civilians, but it was the kind of targets which were selected, where they were selected, and the type of weaponry which was used, which necessarily leads to civilian casualties. The analogy would be somebody throws a hand grenade into a crowd to kill a particular individual, but there are 50 people around. If those 50 people die, well, you know, was it intentional or not? And I think this is a really important point, that when you use these kinds of weapons in the theaters, in the context, and on the ground in which they were being used, you will necessarily have civilian casualties.
What's your view of how the U.S. press treated this whole issue of civilian casualties?
Well, the press here has treated it very differently from the press, say, in Europe, particularly Britain, which is actually, is the partner, really, the military partner in this air war. The British press, at least some of the British press, was much more willing to discuss the destruction which was being wrought upon Afghanistan and the people of Afghanistan, including the hospital system of Afghanistan. The Indian press was very open. The Australian press, a number of journals, particularly The Age, which is a daily in Melbourne, and Sydney Morning Herald, had reporters in the area and on the scene and reported extensively. The press here basically did not. The mainstream press really just stayed away. In effect, I think they became, as somebody said, they became the stenographers of the State Department and the Pentagon.
Just to conclude, Professor Harold, why is it important that Americans know about the details of civilian casualties in Afghanistan? And what do you think the consequences will be in the long run for the United States?
Well, I think not much love has been gained. It behooves us to be aware that we don't have the dream technology, which would simply allow one nation to wage a war where only the bad guys die on the other side. We don't have that. And we're not going to have that for a long time, I think. So I think that's something which is very important. I think what this also raises here is, questions about the independence of the media, both in the past and in the future.
That was Mark Harold, a professor at the University of New Hampshire. His report on civilian casualties in Afghanistan can be found on the Internet at www.cursor.org. While thousands of environmental, labor, and student activists gather in the streets of New York City to protest the elite annual meeting of the World Economic Forum at the end of January, many international activists dedicated to social justice will be gathering in Porto Alegre, Brazil. Some of the world's most powerful corporate and political figures will be in New York to discuss behind closed doors plans to expand free trade, neoliberal economic policy, and their corporate vision for globalization. In stark contrast to the elite gathering in New York, the second annual meeting of the World Social Forum in Brazil will draw tens of thousands of activists, academics, and workers representing a growing global social justice movement who will explore alternative models for economic and environmentally sustainable development. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Victor Minotti, program director with the International Forum on Globalization, who will be attending the meetings in Porto Alegre. He discusses the goals of the World Social Forum and the concrete action which may come out of this international gathering of progressive forces.
Well, the World Social Forum was set up to be the counterpoint to the World Economic Forum. This was an initiative by groups in Brazil and groups throughout the Third World, mostly led by Brazil's very strong labor unions, which has a very strong history of being connected to other social movements. Its environmental movement and landless movement and poor people's movement are also very involved in the organizing of this, as well as a lot of European groups. In fact, I'd say that the European groups are much more central to the organizing so far than are groups from North America. But the idea is that at the same time as the World Economic Forum was always meeting in Davos, that social groups and the leadership and anybody basically who wanted to be involved in such an international discussion would meet in Porto Alegre, Brazil at the same time and talk about alternatives and talk about resistance and how we get from here to there. And the first one was last year. They were expecting about 5,000 people, and about 15,000 people came, largely drawing from all over southern Brazil and Argentina and the southern cone of South America, but a lot of Europeans there again, literally only a handful of Americans. This year they're expecting about 50,000, at least that's what they were saying a few months ago. That's 50,000, but now the numbers seem to be going towards 75,000, so it's... I don't know if it's enough to say, but it's out of control. But it's beyond people's expectation in terms of being a real lightning rod for those who want to see a better world.
Victor, what are some of the goals and objectives of this conference beyond discussing, you know, what kind of world is possible? Are there some concrete things that might come out of this?
Well, keep in mind that there will be a lot of elected officials also in Porto Alegre. There are officials from the California Senate going, from the European Union going, from different, as I said, levels of government who themselves are caught in a bind in trying to deal with globalization. Many governments interested in not only protecting their local economies and local culture, but to do that, they need to know what are the various policy options that are available to them. And that inherently implies that many governments are now beginning to challenge globalization openly, as well as social movements. If you look at it as sort of resistance and then building the alternatives, I think on the resistance side, you're going to see a congealing of some hemispheric plans about really how to respond to this crisis in Argentina and what it means for transforming organizations like the International Monetary Fund. A lot of the blame being put on them for the structural adjustment policies that they had imposed on Argentina for at least over the last decade. And I think you'll see a revived anti-IMF energy coming out of this. The Free Trade Area of the Americas, FTAA, there'll be a lot more high-profile campaign that comes out of this. And I think people developing clear plans for the next time the ministers of the Americas meet in Quito, Ecuador, in October of this year. Something that wasn't really on the agenda last year that will come out quite prominently this year is going to be the whole sustainability and ecological agenda, and how we respond as an international movement to a global economy that is absolutely based on unsustainable systems of production and consumption. The big opportunity coming up is in August of this year, August of 2002. That's when we have the so-called Rio Plus 10 meeting. In 1992, Rio de Janeiro hosted the UN Earth Summit, and now here we are, 2002. It'll be the 10-year review. It's going to happen in Johannesburg, South Africa, another very dynamic country in terms of social movements. And I think you're going to see some real electrifying plans come out of Porto Alegre this year about how to connect these two agendas and to bring the World Social Forum message into that process for the Johannesburg Summit in August.
While delegates meet in conferences and discuss these economic and social issues, there are also demonstrations and other types of actions. Maybe you could describe those, again, that occurred last year and what the plans are for this time around.
Well, I have to say that like a lot of the economic summits here and the resistance that gravitates around them, there's really kind of a carnival atmosphere that one finds in Porto Alegre during the conference. They opened up the conference with a big march through the middle of town, where not only was the local government there sponsoring this conference and welcoming everybody, but you actually had police forces on the side of the streets going through the main part of town, cheering on the delegates, you know, the protesters from all over the world who would come to participate in the World Social Forum. So this state in Brazil, Rio Grande do Sul, has the highest standard of living in all of Brazil. Its municipal government is elected from the Workers' Party. It has a highly participatory process for setting the state and the municipal budget, and it's really sort of a model in that way. And the atmosphere is, again, really festive, but a lot of serious work getting done and a lot of excellent cross-border organizing that takes place.
That was Victor Minotti, Program Director with the International Forum on Globalization. Contact the forum by calling area code 415-561-3482 or visit their website at www.ifg.org. The World Social Forum website can be accessed at www.worldsocialforum.org. The Cabinet Mountains comprise 94,000 acres of designated wilderness in the far northwest corner of Montana. It is here that a mining company has proposed developing a copper and silver mine and has received approval to do so from the U.S. Forest Service and the Montana Department of Environmental Quality. This project pits the 1872 Mining Act against the 1964 Wilderness Act. The Mining Act allows extractive industries to take out natural resources while paying only a tiny fraction of their worth, often leaving environmental devastation in their wake. The Wilderness Act decrees that the land so designated should be free of impact by humans. Several citizens' lawsuits are planned or already underway to try to stop the mine from being established. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Roger Flynn, an attorney with the Western Mining Action Project, a nonprofit environmental law center based in Boulder, Colorado. The group, founded in 1993, represents citizens groups and Native American tribes on Western mining issues. Flynn describes the Cabinet Mountain Wilderness Area, the threat presented by the proposed mine, and the campaign being organized to stop it.
Well, the Cabinet Mountain Wilderness in northwest, far northwest Montana is one of the last really pristine areas in the country that one you can access pretty easily. And also, it is a refuge for threatened grizzly bears and other species such as the bull trout, which is a large trout species that's on its last leg. It's heavily forested. It rises steeply from the valley of the Clark Fork River, which drains western Montana, eventually flows into the Columbia River. And it's just spectacular, towering mountains, thick forests, rich wildlife, crystal clear streams, certainly not the place for one of the country's largest mining operations.
And what does Sterling Mining Company want to do there?
Sterling's has just been authorized by the United States Forest Service, which owns the land. Most of the land is public land owned by the citizens of the United States. And the Forest Service and the state of Montana has recently authorized Sterling to bore a number of tunnels under the wilderness area, some as long as 3 miles in under the wilderness area, and run a mining operation underground with some tunnels poking out into the wilderness area above where the mine will be located. The mine would operate for about 30 years, produce hundreds of millions of tons of waste and byproducts, and they want to dump the waste right outside the wilderness area at the portal to the tunnels, basically, along Rock Creek and the Clark Fork River, which is one of the major western rivers.
The wilderness areas that were designated, I believe, by the Wilderness Act in 1964 specifically require that these lands be, quote, untrammeled by man, unquote. And in an article that I read about this issue, it said that a spokesperson for the mining company said that they would be untrammeled on the surface. What are some of the things that you and other people there you represent fear could happen if a mine is dug underneath this property?
Well, any claim that they would not be impacting the surface of the wilderness area is just plain false. The Forest Service is authorizing one of the mine tunnels that would allow ventilation from the underground mine to escape, would be bored through and would daylight, so to speak, into the federally protected wilderness area. So to say that nothing would happen to the surface is just flat out wrong. Also, some of the geologic reports that were done recently to try to analyze the impacts from the mine showed that there was a concern about the wilderness surface itself, the surface of the land, dropping or subsiding, layperson's term, caving in onto the mine. And there's a number of wilderness lakes and wildlife habitat that would be obliterated if that would happen. Most of the residents in downstream Idaho and in that area of Montana just believe that this is not the place to turn a pristine wilderness area and the area lands right next to that wilderness area to turn it into an industrial, essentially toxic waste zone. And I just can't think of a more dramatic conflict between what's known as the 1872 mining law, which was the mining law that encouraged mining of the public lands that was signed by President Ulysses Grant, which is still on the books intact today. I can't think of a more dramatic conflict between the 1872 mining law and what people out west now value about the west, which is wilderness and wildlife habitat and open spaces, which as the west grows is becoming in very short supply.
How are you approaching the case to say that the Wilderness Act should take precedence over the earlier Mining Act of 1872?
Well, the Wilderness Act is just one of the many problems. So the impact on the wilderness is just one of many problems with this mine. Frankly, the mining pollution into Rock Creek, which is spawning habitat for a number of imperiled fish species, the impact on the major Clark Fork River, there's the decimation of the grizzly bear habitats in the area, are all reasons why this mine should not be approved. The Wilderness Act, protecting the land and resources in the wilderness area, are just one of the impacts that we feel should not be allowed to occur here. When you boil it all down, they're giving the benefit of the doubt to Sterling Mining Company versus the benefit of the doubt to the public, to people living downstream, and to the wildlife and to the habitat. And frankly, that appears to be the Bush administration's modus operandi these days, that the big extractive industries, whether it's oil and gas or mining, they get the benefit of the doubt where the public gets basically the shaft.
That was Roger Flynn of the Western Mining Action Project. For more information, contact the project at area code 303-473-9618. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.